Hi, Patrick Cox here in the World Newsroom in Boston, and this is The World in Words number 31. We have a
terrific
lineup today, full of
sensuous
words invented by John Milton, a man who enjoyed
embellishing
the English language. Also, Shakespeare, Orwell, and a tough-to-translate naming ceremony.
As a free man, I take pride in the word, Ich bin ein Berliner.
Why, as an American, do I have to push a button to speak English?
Don't let me miss the open door. Show me where the open door is. Even if it's cracked up a little bit, man, maybe I'll plow right on through that.
And thank you, Borat. The World is co-produced by the BBC World Service, Public Radio International, and WGBH in Boston. You can hear The Big Show on more than 250 public radio stations around the United States. For more on that, and for more on all of our podcasts, go to theworld.org. This week and next, we're going to be spending some time in the company of people who play around with the English language. This week, it's some old dead guys, Shakespeare, Milton, Orwell. Next week, some newer writers, Juno Diaz, Louise Bennett, Linton Kwesi Johnson, and many others, people who write in so-called rotten English. So we're dividing this into 2 weeks, old and new, I guess. But if you listen to this week and to next, I hope you'll agree that this week's old guys are just as radical and inventive as next week's newbies. So let's start with Shakespeare. Now, you may be aware that I have a thing about public radio clichés. Utter the word Shakespeare and I run a mile from my radio. And the reason is there is a favorite setting for, let's call it the living Shakespeare story. And that setting is the inner city school. You have the students who act in a Shakespeare play, playing the likes of Hamlet, Laertes, Gertrude. And here's the message that you get in this public radio story. We may have poverty in this country. Our cities may be blighted, our neighborhoods violent, our public schools failing. But if you stick a copy of Hamlet into a kid's hands, he'll be liberated. He'll soar way above his deprived surroundings. See? America's okay after all. So, it was with some trepidation that I listened to a segment on The Big Show, a segment that I am going to play you in a minute. It was a Shakespeare segment featuring none other than an inner city school in Los Angeles. But as it turns out, this one avoids the cliches, actually tells me a thing or two. So here goes with The World's Lisa Mullins.
In Shakespeare's play As You Like It, the character Jaques talks about the seven ages of man.
At first the infant, mewling and puking in the nurse's arms. Then the whining schoolboy with his satchel and shining morning face, creeping like snail unwillingly to school.
Well, put it like that, and school doesn't sound like much fun at all. And for some kids, doing Shakespeare at school can seem even worse. So the UK's Royal Shakespeare Company is mounting a campaign to change all that. They want British school kids to encounter Shakespeare by age 11 at the latest. Jackie O'Hanlon is the company's acting head of education.
What we want to see is young people exploring the plays practically. And that means they're up on their feet and they're playing with the text like we would as actors in rehearsals. And we also want them to see Shakespeare live. And we want to see Shakespeare explored earlier. We don't want it to start when students get to secondary school and when they're age 14 and probably least likely to want to engage with it.
That's Jackie O'Hanlon of the Royal Shakespeare Company in the UK. Here are a couple of children from the Churchill Gardens Primary School in central London. This is one of the schools where the Royal Shakespeare Company has started to work.
I don't like Shakespeare because they have too many, big words and I don't understand it.
It's good because, you learn olden times words and you find out what's love really about.
Rafe Esquith is a teacher who knows something about bringing Shakespeare alive in the classroom. His fifth grade students perform Shakespeare year-round at Hobart Boulevard Elementary School in Los Angeles. You heard those kids there. One of them said, I don't like Shakespeare because of the big words, but another one had a more positive review on Shakespeare. Does that resonate with what your fifth graders think?
I mean, in the early days, yeah. When I first did Shakespeare 25 years ago, people thought I was crazy. But we have such momentum now. Everybody wants to be in Shakespeare. My problem is I have too many kids.
How many do you have?
I work with between 60 and 100 after school.
Oh, my gosh. And you can actually keep them focused on this awkward English.
It's not awkward to us. It's just language. And words like awkward never come into my class, and we don't see it that way. Teaching is really about building a relationship with your students. And so many classrooms are based on fear, and my classroom is based on trust.
Now, what does that mean? Because for some of them, the language of Shakespeare is going to be completely foreign in every possible way. How do you build trust when you're, say, quoting somebody like Jaques, who we heard earlier?
Well, it was funny because we're doing As You Like It this year, and I've got a little 9.5-year-old boy who does Jaques, and I think even better than the actor that you had on. And the reason they are willing to do that is because, as Jackie was saying earlier, my students have seen a lot of Shakespeare. Shakespeare is never meant to be read. It's a terrible read. Shakespeare is meant to be heard and to watch. In Shakespeare's day, people didn't say, let's go watch a play. They said, let's go hear a play. It's all available. You can download it. It's on CD. And I'm there to explain the meaning of the words. But the themes, Lisa, absolutely connect with the children. I mean, when we did Henry IV, Henry IV is about a young prince who's trying to find honor in a dishonorable world and to find peace and harmony in a violent world. If you don't think a kid growing up in poverty in central Los Angeles understands those themes, you are very much mistaken. It's not just about deciphering the language, but it's about feeling and understanding what these themes are all about. Anybody can recite Shakespeare, but if you can recite it with real feeling and commit it as part of your soul, the themes in Shakespeare are universal.
All right, Rafe Esquith, fifth grade teacher at Hobart Boulevard Elementary School in Los Angeles. Very nice to talk to you.
Thanks for having me, Lisa. I really appreciate it.
What is it about all those words Shakespeare is said to have invented? Words like eyeball and premeditated and jaded. How many of them are there anyway? Well, as it turns out, it depends. Some people say Shakespeare invented more than 1,700 words. Others say it's far, far fewer than that. It comes down to definitions. A lot of the words weren't actually invented by the bard, but he coined them. He used them for the first time in print, or at least in print that survives today. So Shakespeare gets the credit for, well, anything from addiction to zany. Sometimes he endowed a word with new meaning. Sometimes he strung new words and old ones together in all sorts of magnificent combinations. He certainly deserves credit for a line like, "He hath eaten me out of house and home," or "There's daggers in men's smiles." But when it comes to making up words, Shakespeare might actually have been less inventive than John Milton. Yes, John Milton, the bane of many British school kids' lives. Milton may have been inventive, but his poetry wasn't nearly as jokey or smutty as Shakespeare's. Well, had John Milton invented immortality, get this, he'd be 400 next month. Here's more on Milton's words from The World's Alex Galifant.
John Milton is most famous for this poem, Paradise Lost.
Of man's first disobedience, and the fruit of that forbidden tree whose mortal taste brought death into the world, and all our woe with loss of Eden, till one greater man restore us and regain the blissful seat. Sing, heavenly muse.
Milton's language may not sound that strange today, but back in the 1600s, his words would have sounded otherworldly. Milton was a big-picture poet. He wanted to express new thoughts about good and evil, about the nature of society, about almost everything. If the words he wanted didn't exist already, he made them up.
Poets need to invent words not only to describe the sorts of extraordinary things that you get in poetry, but simply to fit in with the constraints of writing in verse.
Gavin Alexander lectures in English at Cambridge University. Alexander has been scouring the Oxford English Dictionary, the go-to tome on the history of English words. He's been scouring this thing, trawling through it to see which poet came up with which words. Shakespeare, a notable neologist, a creator of words, ended up with a tally of 229. Not bad. But Milton came in at around 630. Some of these words are absolutely
terrific.
That's one of them right there. And you can't be
dismissive
of these words. Many are still in use. To understand how the words came about, it's necessary to unpick
the padlock
of Milton's time. Milton lived through a period of intense social change. He himself imagined what it would be like to live in an England with no king or queen. And, says Gavin Alexander, Milton's epic, Paradise Lost, is in part about freedom of will and freedom from God.
He's a theorist of freedom and a practicer of freedoms, and I think part of that freedom is the freedom he uses the English language with.
Unlike Shakespeare, John Milton isn't that well known today. That's even true in his homeland, where his poems are no longer required reading in schools. But his words are still alive. We should thank this poet for
embellishing
the English language, creating a degree of linguistic
pandemonium.
One of Milton's words is pretty
sensuous.
That's the verb
to intervolve.
It means to wind together. For nearly 400 years, this beautiful term went largely unused. Thank goodness, then, for a company in Raleigh, North Carolina, providing supply chain software to the beverage industry. The sublime John Milton lives on thanks to Intervolve Incorporated, established 1999. For The World, I'm Alex Galifant.
Alex tried to get a comment from Intervolve for his story, but they weren't talking. I guess the subject was just a tad too controversial. Okay, fast forward to the 20th century. Another English writer to come up with a few words that have stuck is George Orwell. But there's an irony. We love ironies. And that is that many of the words Orwell is remembered for are exactly the type of expressions he hated. You know, words that didn't expose the truth. They covered it up. His novel 1984, of course, is full of these words. Thought crime. Joy camp, belly feel. These words were all part of the fictional government-sponsored language of newspeak, the only language in the world whose vocabulary gets smaller every year. I love that. In his non-fiction, Orwell was known to rail against the purveyors of those sorts of bureaucratic words. His prose style was extremely spare, famously spare, and that's on display in his diary, now released in blog form. You can listen to the story about how his diary became a blog in The World in Words number 19. It is his diary entries released online exactly 70 years later. It's been up and running since August, and The World's technology correspondent Clark Boyd has become an addict of the Orwell blog. I asked Clark to read me the latest entry.
One egg. That's all he's given us, is one egg. Now, what's incredible is to note the number of comments that this brings up on the blog. Because if you followed it from the beginning, you know he's not talking about what he's eating, although that seems to be the most popular interpretation of it if people have joined the blog late. So you've got, you know, people leaving messages like, boy, that dude loved eggs, because you can have 5 days in a row where it's just one egg, two eggs. What he's talking about, he and his wife, they have left England and they've moved to Morocco and they've set up shop there and they're planting a garden. And they have chickens. And so what he's really talking about is the number of eggs that the chickens have laid on any given day.
Okay, well, let's go back a couple weeks to, you know, if anybody couldn't decide on who they were going to vote for president, and, you know, maybe they wanted to check in with George Orwell to see if he could give them any hints.
Well, on election day itself, one egg.
Oh, not even two.
What I like is the following day, one egg. Now, the day before the election, the third, yesterday, one egg. Fine sunset with green sky. But he actually goes on there, and you do get some of that incredible description. He's obsessed with the weather. He's obsessed with how his plants are doing. He's incredibly obsessed with the number of dead animals that he finds around in Morocco. And I've been to Morocco, and you do see dead animals quite frequently. You know, he's going on, the half-starved donkey, which I think was bought recently, has discovered that the goats are given barley and comes across to rob them of it. If you want to, you can start reading things into this, like his sort of longings for social justice, even in these diary entries. But I think the one thing to remember about Orwell's diaries here is that Orwell had many, many other writing outlets, right? I mean, this is just really his personal day-to-day thing, and it makes for great blog entries.
Now, this was inspired in part by the diary entries that were released in blog form of Samuel Pepys, which began in 2003.
Yeah.
How did the two compare?
Well, I think going back to what I said about Orwell, he had a number of different writing outlets. So, you know, he's not just writing these diaries. He's also, you know, starting to come up with his novels, his journalism, his nonfiction. Pepys didn't have any other outlet.
He was a diarist.
This is his outlet. And you have to remember, too, that he's 17th century London. He's in the midst of the plague. He's married to a woman that he doesn't really particularly care for. And so his diary entries have this incredible, over-the-top sort of salacious quality to them. They're incredibly descriptive. Sometimes Orwell, you don't really feel like you're inhabiting his world in these diaries, but if you read Pepys for any length of time, you really come to inhabit London in the 17th century. So if we just compare the latest diary entry of Orwell, which was One Egg, remember, to this description that Pepys has. Now, Pepys was a businessman, right? And so he spent a lot of time going on to boats that were coming in from around the world and looking at the riches. You know, you can always tell that he's just can't wait to get his hands on all the riches. So here he is walking into this boat that's just come in. Pepper scattered through every chink, you trod upon it, and in cloves and nutmegs, I walked above the knees, whole rooms full, and silk in bales and boxes of copper plate, one of which I saw opened. I mean, it's just all of these incredible descriptions, and the people who read it on a regular basis and comment on it are like, oh my goodness, you know, you can almost smell it, you can taste it, you can feel it, you're there in the boat with him. And I think, you know, because he didn't have any other outlet for writing, that this is the kind of stuff that he loves to put in the blog.
Yeah, it's a little more evocative than One Egg.
It's definitely more evocative, but I think that's what makes, if you read them both at the same time, it makes for great sort of companion pieces, even though they're, you know, hundreds of years apart in their sense and their sensibility. They go together quite well, like Pepper and Eggs.
The World's technology correspondent, Clark Boyd. You can hear Clark's technology podcast on iTunes. There's also a Facebook page, or go to theworld.org/technology. Now it's time to name that segment. A little music, please, Maestro. Ah, that's better. To recap, due to popular demand, The World in Words has begun a regular segment of what I have temporarily called TTT, tough to translate, foreign words and phrases, for which there's no clear or easy English equivalent. Well, tough to translate is a lousy name, and I'm lousy at naming things. I didn't even come up with The World in Words. Thank you, Herr Sussman, for that. So, for this segment, I asked you to come up with a name. There were many suggestions. Here's one. How to You Say. Nice. And another. Lost in Translation. Great, but overused. Here's a fantastic one. Hotties. Yes, hotties. It stands for hard ones to translate into English. I may regret it, but I'm not going with hotties. So, after much consideration, I decided on, well, I'll get to it by way of an amazing Japanese word. Here it is.
Yokomeshi.
Yokomeshi, as pronounced by my friend Tomoko Yokoyama.
Yeah, I didn't know about this word.
She didn't know about it, so she posted an inquiry on a Japanese social networking site.
And my friend commented on this and said, oh, you know, I used to work in a company, Tokyo, and then this means that the eating dinner or meal with somebody who speaks English.
And why does yokomeshi mean eating a meal with somebody who speaks English? Well, yoko means horizontal, as in yokomoji, which means horizontal words. Horizontal words indicate a language from the West, usually English. You read across the page, not down, as you do in Japanese. So that's yoko. The second half of the word, meshi, means boiled rice or a meal. Put them together and you have a word that conveys the disorienting sensation of speaking a foreign language, eating horizontally or eating sideways. And that's what we're going to call this segment, Eating Sideways. That's it for this week. Send me your comments and your Eating Sideways suggestions. Post them at the Facebook group, The World in Words, or email me. The address is language@pri.org. Next week, it's Rotten English. That sounds like British dentistry. Talk to you then.